Thank you very much. My name is Ben Habib. As Michael's just told you, North Korea and all things Northeast Asia is my primary research interest. And it's a pleasure for me to have made the long drive down here today. Has anyone here been to Korea, North or South? No. Do you know anything about these countries? Such as what? What have you heard?
Pyongyang.
Yeah.
Showroom sort of city.
Yeah, that's true. Potemkin Village, it's called, in the communist parlance. A make-believe propaganda place. And that's exactly what it is. Has anyone seen this inauspicious block of concrete? But it's more than just a block of concrete, hey? Yeah, that's right. This is the 38th parallel. This is the border at the village, a small village called Panmunjom, in the demilitarized zone where the troops, the North Korean and South Korean troops, face off at each other, and also tourists face off at each other from across the line. And there you can see the feet of a North Korean border guard. But this is more than just a slab of concrete. This symbolizes what we're going to be talking about today. A set of divisions. The Korean Peninsula is characterized by a number of divisions. One, strategic divisions, which we're going to look at. Ideological divisions and economic divisions. Now we'll get to that, but what I'm going to talk about first is to give you some historic context about the lead up to the division of Korea in 1945 and to see why that might have taken place. What conditions made Korea fertile for division and domination by great powers? And what we see is this is a gradually unfolding tragedy, the division of Korea. It's not something that just happened in 1945, but it was the product of a lead up of a long decay of what was a united Korean state. Now, does anyone know how long the political entity of Korea was united before 1945?
Since 1000 AD.
Yeah, that's right. It was, till 1945, a united country for 1,000 years. Firstly, under the Goryeo dynasty, which was a Buddhist dynastic lineage, and then under the Joseon dynasty, which was Neo-Confucian, having got rid of the Buddhists. And that Neo-Confucian lineage is why both Koreas today have a very Confucian culture, which is obvious to anyone that travels there. What we saw, especially in the later 19th century, is that the Korean Peninsula became the plaything of great powers. Koreans often say that they feel like a shrimp sandwiched between two whales, and the two whales being Japan and China. Now, why might that be the case? Apart from the fact that Korea is small, but why is Korea sandwiched between the two?
Colonial
entities. Yeah, but why? There's an obvious fact if you look at a map. Why then are they sandwiched? Yeah, that's right. Korea is an invasion corridor either way, so it's a vital piece of strategic real estate. Now, what we saw in the 19th century is that we saw three main players, especially in the latter half, take an interest in Korea. One, we had China under the late Qing Empire. We had the Russians, who had a heavy interest in the Russian Far East, and also had possessions in Manchuria, which is now part of northern China. And we had the Japanese, who were beginning their imperial expansion into the Asian mainland. In 1894-95, we had a war between the Chinese and the Japanese. And that the defeat of China, and then the later defeat, Japan's victory over the Russians, really cleared the way for Japan's competitors, got them out of the way, swept them out of the Korean Peninsula, and made it safe for the Japanese to commence their movement into the Korean Peninsula. And Korea became the springboard for Japan's expansion into the Asian mainland as we move forward in the 20th century. So the Japanese occupied South Korea in 1905. What you see in the picture here The guys dressed in black, they're Japanese troops. This is a very famous gate in the capital of South Korea, Seoul. These guys are called Yangban. They're like the upper class of Korean society at that time. They're the elites. And then you see some lower class people in the background here. The Japanese, they're in Korea in 1905. They then formally annexed the Korean Peninsula as a Japanese imperial territory in 1911. So what do they do when they're in Korea? Do you know anything about the Japanese occupation of Korea?
Description.
Yep. So especially when the Japanese are fighting against the Chinese and then later against the Americans. Ethnic Korean men are conscripted into the Japanese Imperial Army. What happens to some of the Korean women?
Well, they're
right. Yeah, for the purpose of what? Yeah, yeah. So there's a core of men and women who are taken to Japan as industrial workers. Yeah. So have you ever heard the term comfort women? A lot of young Korean girls were forced into sex slavery for the Japanese imperial troops. And they're still fighting for justice today. If you go to in Seoul at the Japanese embassy, there's a small, every Wednesday morning I think, there's a small gathering of former comfort women and their supporters who are asking the Japanese government for compensation and for an apology. Alright, let's fast forward to 1945. What does this depict? Very famous picture. Yes, this is on the USS Missouri on the 2nd of September 1945, the formal ending to World War II. Now, this is an important event for our story here because the lesson is Korea did not liberate itself. Koreans were not freed by their own actions. They were liberated from the Japanese yoke by other superpowers, and then the Korean Peninsula became the business of those superpowers rather than a free entity in and of itself. So the division of the peninsula is an interesting story. Right near the end of the Pacific War, the Russians, they're in Manchuria, and they declare war on Japan and start racing through Manchuria and down into the Korean Peninsula. The Americans see this and they decide that they need to get into Korea quick smart. And it has been argued by some scholars that one of the rationales, they're not the only one, for dropping the atomic bombs on Japan was to end the war quickly and stop the Soviet advance into Korea and then possibly into Japan. So what happens is they meet about halfway down the Korean Peninsula at the 38th parallel. And Russian officers and American officers are deciding what they're going to do, how they're going to come to some kind of political agreement to manage their advance through here. And there was one American officer who decides, okay, the 38th parallel, we're roughly there, sets this as the arbitrary boundary, doesn't consult any Koreans. No one in the American force speaks Korean, so they can't speak to the local population. And he draws this division. With the only aid he used was a National Geographic map from the 1930s. So that seems quite a ridiculous way to draw a national boundary, but that's how it was done, and that's the division we're stuck with today. Now, it didn't take long for this division to spark hostilities. You had two separate systems develop under the two different annexing powers. In the north, you had a government headed by Kim Il-sung, who'd been given support by the Soviets. And in the south, you had a government sponsored by the Americans, headed by Syngman Rhee. And both of them were claiming to be the legitimate government of Korea. Both of them were espousing different ideologies. And both of them were becoming increasingly violent in their attempts to claim their right to rule all of Korea as the legitimate leadership. So what we saw in 1950 is Kim Il-sung in the north, rapid invasion of South Korea, and we get the Korean War. So initially the North Korean troops, as you can see in this diagram, came through here and made a very rapid advance down into the south and captured everything but this small area, the pink area there, the Pusan perimeter. Then what happens? Does anyone know the chronology here?
Douglas MacArthur launches the invasion of Incheon.
Yeah, that's right. So Incheon's up here near Seoul, where the airport is now.
UN mandate. UN mandate.
It was launched under the auspices of the United Nations, yeah. But it's primarily an American force, but there are contributions from other countries, including Australia. I think there was about 19 countries or something thereabouts that were involved. So yes, MacArthur launches his surprise attack here. They force the North Koreans back over the 38th parallel and force them all the way up to here, the Yalu River. And that's when China enters the war, because they don't want American troops and wearing blue hats or otherwise right on their frontier. So the Chinese enter the war, force the UN forces back down here, and after 3 years they end up exactly where they started, at the cost of 2 million lives at least, countless refugees, and two countries that are essentially flattened. So it's a very sad story, the Korean War. Interestingly, we talked about MacArthur. Here he is. A testament to the fact that aviator sunnies will always be cool. Taken around World War II. Now, he was a World War II hero in the fight against Japan. He then becomes the leader of the UN mission in Korea. But famously, he lobbied very strongly to President Truman to give him the authorization to drop 26 atomic bombs along the Yalu River frontier to lay what he called a strip of cobalt, a radioactive zone that the Chinese couldn't send men through as a defense. Not long after that, he was relieved of his command on the grounds that he was a megalomaniac. So it's very lucky for us that he didn't get his way. Now, let's talk divisions a bit further. I've used the word fractured in the title of my lecture. Why is that? Well, as I alluded to at the start, the division of Korea is more than just a line at the 38th parallel. It's a division that embodies strategic competition. And we're going to explore that here. And part of that strategic competition is the US alliance with South Korea. Now, why do you think South Korea and the United States might be allied? We've had the Korean War. The Americans have helped to beat back the North. Got the Cold War going on. Have a stab. What do you think?
Yeah, economic ramifications.
Yep. Yep. Which would be
markets.
Yep. Yep. So you've got a flattened country, you need to rebuild. What's the best method? We'll come back to that. Yeah, what about over here, up the back somewhere? Why might the young South Korean government want to maintain an alliance with the United States?
Security.
Yeah. So, you want to expand? Yeah, that's right. It was an armistice. The war hasn't finished. South Korea never signed the armistice. So technically, they're still at war. But yes, you've got a country that's been flattened, it's exhausted, it can't really defend itself again. So you need your superpower patron to come and help you out. What about today? What's the rationale for the US alliance? Yep, yep.
Regional stabilization.
Yep. Yep. Also, if the United States is paying for most of your defence, you don't have to. So it lightens the load of your defence burden because someone else is taking a majority of this responsibility. Also, South Korea, they're protected under the American nuclear umbrella. So they're protected from nuclear attack from another power. Which is good news when your northern neighbour decides to develop nuclear weapons. The alliance has also had cultural ramifications on South Korean society. So, for example, the baseball. Baseball's big in South Korea. All the hallmarks of American pop culture, the Starbucks cafes, all the material stuff that you'd associate with the West. It's all there in South Korea today. What might be a drawback, though, of being closely allied to the US?
China doesn't like you very much.
Yeah. Although South Korea and China have got an interesting, a very strong and close economic relationship now. So one of the things South Korea has to do is navigate between its security relationship with Washington and its economic relationship with Beijing.
In that respect, you've got a lack of individual foreign policy. You have to toe the line of your patron.
Yeah, that's right. So South Korea is in danger of becoming overly entangled in American global hegemonic interests and forays in a way that otherwise might not. Also, there's something called a status of forces agreement, which is not unique to South Korea. It's something that the United States signs with every country in which it maintains military bases. Has anyone ever heard of the status of forces agreement before? Basically, this means if you're an American soldier and you commit a crime in South Korea, you don't get tried under South Korean law. You're not subject to the local system of justice. So when I was there in 2002, an American military truck ran over 2 9-year-old girls. And those men were never had to face any kind of justice in South Korea. And there was a big outcry among the South Korean public about this. And this is one of numerous examples stretching back all the way to the Korean War. Little things, small antagonisms that add up and pile up and result in an undercurrent of anti-Americanism in some quarters of the South Korean public. So this is where the South Korea-US alliance fits in, within this broader framework of the hub and spokes alliance system. Now, has Michael talked about this at all in his lectures? Yeah. And I'm sure you would have heard about this in other subjects too. It's the basis of the United States' Pacific military posture. So in Europe, we've got NATO. It's a coordinated alliance institution. In the Pacific, the United States has individual bilateral security relationships, of which South Korea is a part. In the Cold War, what was the reason for maintaining these relationships? Yeah, who was the big boogeyman in the Cold War?
Russia.
Yeah, so the Soviet Union. So they're containing Soviet expansion into the East Asian littoral. And another reason that's been advanced is also to keep these countries from doing anything stupid that would entangle the United States in a global war during the Cold War. What about today? What's the purpose of maintaining the hub and spoke system for Washington? I heard China mentioned. Yeah.
Stability.
Yep.
Containment.
Yep, all of those things. So now China is, I wouldn't say use the word adversary, but it's the country of interest for the United States in this region. And keep an eye on that at the moment, especially with the scandal involving the blind activist. Very interesting times there. Now, let's shift our attention now to North Korea and its relationship with the communist bloc. So obviously, at its inception, North Korea is a client state of the Soviet Union. The Soviets have installed its leader, Kim Il-sung, and they have an ongoing relationship. But then it also has its neighbour who helped it out in the Korean War, China. And here we see Kim Il-sung. Where is he? There with Mao. And then Zhou Enlai, just to the left there. So these are both. Mao described this relationship with North Korea as close as lips and teeth. Now, what happened between the Soviet Union and China in the 50s and 60s? Something happens to their relationship.
Split.
Yeah, so you get the Sino-Soviet split. So if you're a smaller Eastern Bloc country like North Korea, what does that mean for your relationship with both of these heavyweights of the Communist Bloc? Yes, that's one option.
Play them off against each other.
Yeah, and that's what the option that the North Koreans take. They play them off against each other. So, if I'm Kim Il-sung and I want some favourable economic concessions, or I want some aid of some kind, I go to both countries. I might go to Moscow and say, the Chinese have offered me $10 million or 10 million rubles worth of grain. Can you help me out? Give me a bit more. Up the offer. And then he'll go back to Beijing and say, all right, the Russians have offered me this. What can you do for me? You know, it's playing two sides off against each other. Very easy to do. And that was the posture that the North Koreans took there. And we'll talk about a bit more about that later. What we also see, though, is that North Korea becomes trapped in a cycle of dependency where they're reliant on economic inputs that come from other communist bloc countries. And this has major ramifications at the end of the Cold War when the Soviet Union collapses. Now, obviously, the Soviet Union does not exist anymore, and the Russian state that succeeded the USSR conducted a sort of strategic withdrawal from East Asia at the end of the Cold War, and only now they're starting to re-engage in that theatre. But they're not major players like they were in the Cold War. The DPRK-China relationship is the big one for our purposes. But that relationship's also changed a lot since Mao said it's as close as lips and teeth. And what we get is a China that's becoming increasingly irritated by the provocations launched by the North Korean regime, essentially without its permission, without any consideration for the wider ramifications of these events on Chinese strategic interests, which include, you know, its hegemonic struggle at the moment with the United States. What we also see is that China doesn't have as much leverage over North Korea as people in the West would make out, because North Korea has value to China in a strategic sense. So I talked before about in the Korean War, the Chinese leaders of the time didn't want American troops on their frontier at the Yalu River. Nothing's changed since that time. North Korea, for China, acts as a buffer state between themselves and their adversary in the United States in the south of Korea. And that makes sense. Also, a lot of Chinese companies are investing in North Korea. North Korea's economy is starting to open up, though not to Western investors, but definitely to maverick Chinese investors who are looking to get into virgin market territory, particularly in the mining sector. All right, that's the strategic story. Now let's think about the ideological division, the ideological competition that characterises the North-South division. And again, we bear in mind, it's a contest between two halves of what they consider to be the same country, having a contest over who is the legitimate Korea, who is the legitimate government, who has the legitimate economic and political system. Now, interestingly, at the beginning of this division, the political systems weren't all that divergent. We know about the North Korean dictatorship. In the South, we also had an authoritarian military dictatorship, which was in power under a couple of different leaders until the late 1980s. So this man here is Park Chung-hee. He was president from the mid-60s until the early 1980s when he was assassinated by his bodyguard. Not a very good bodyguard. So yeah, what we think of now of South Korea as a democratic country, but we have to remember that it's only 20 years ago that it started gaining democratic tendencies. It was an authoritarian country up to that point. And in some respects, you look at South Korean politics and you can still see these authoritarian tendencies play out in how politics is governed in that country. Looking back at North Korea, there's ideas in that country that permeate North Korean ideology that relate to ideas of racial purity. So for a start, North Koreans are virulently anti-Japanese, and you can understand that, stemming back from the occupation. They're also anti-American, and you can understand that. But are they anti-South Korean? This is a more interesting question. And the answer is, they see the Koreans, all Koreans, as brothers, even their deluded brothers in the South. And South Koreans would look north and say, yes, they're different, but they're still Koreans. So there's a very strong racial bond there. But all of these three things play into a nationalism that's what I would call a wounded nationalism, where you've got a country that has a long history of being subjected to the yoke of other great powers, that's undergone a lot of suffering, that's undergone a lot of internal struggle and warfare. This is a country with a lot of hurt pride, and this plays out in their very xenophobic view of how they see the outside world. And that's not necessarily restricted to North Korea. You can see strands of that in South Korea. Although, funnily enough, the South Korean football team's performance in the 2002 World Cup was, interestingly, a coming out party for that half of the peninsula that made them start to see the world in a different and more confident way. And I was there at the time and it was very noticeable. It was a great time to be in Korea. Has anyone heard the term juche before? Yeah, it's a very common term that gets thrown around. Do you know what it means?
Self-reliance.
Yeah, that's the literal interpretation in English.
Self-support, I believe.
Yeah. Both are correct, although there's a lot more to it than that. So let's explore that. If you're a country, what does it mean to be self-reliant? Yep.
Security.
Yep. What about strategic resources? It means you have them. You don't need to bargain and trade with other countries. Do any of those things apply to North Korea? No, not at all. So this is much more about propaganda. And it doesn't mean self-reliance in the strictest sense. It means it's more about Korea centrism, putting Korea first. And again, after this long history of being messed around by other great powers, you can see why this kind of idea has appeal and why it's a good rallying point for your domestic political constituents. And also when the North Koreans are playing off, or were playing off, the Soviets and the Chinese, they can say, oh, we're practicing juche, self-reliance. Another dimension of North Korean ideology is nationalism, is this personality cult of Kim Il-sung. So here's Kim Il-sung, he's the regime founder. We're not talking about a cult of personality. What does that involve? What does that entail?
Deification.
Sorry?
Deification.
Yeah, so...
and the godlike status.
Yeah, so if I wanted to set one up for myself, what kind of things would I need to do?
Indoctrinate youth.
Yep, so you're the youth. What would I have to tell you?
Stories.
Yep, what kind of stories?
Preferably one that has a sort of...
pleasant setting in the rural heartland. You rise through power just due to your purity of ideological conviction.
Yeah, so I was born in the middle of the MCG on the cricket pitch on Boxing Day. That's the level of silliness that these cults have.
The bat and ball in the
hand. Yes, came out swinging. Do they need to be true to have power?
Need to be believed.
Yeah. What else would I need to set up this cult?
Somebody to implement a secret police.
Yep, that definitely helps. So if anyone says, nah, it's bullshit, he wasn't born in the MCG, there'd be someone there to send him off to the camps, yep.
The proper conditions that would make people want to look up to someone instead of themselves.
Yep, so what might that entail?
Financial crisis, hunger, lack of resources, just going down the drain, basically.
Yep, and so who's going to fix that problem? Me, the leader. I'm the answer to all your problems.
In the face of adversity, somebody to...
Probably also need something you can point at and say that's the big evil that I'm fighting against.
Yep, all of the above. Very good. Also, you need rituals. You need official texts saying why I'm the fountain of everything. So Mao had them, the little red books. You will have all seen them. North Koreans don't have as much in the way of text, but they do have rituals that you have to perform. Has anyone heard of something called self-criticism? Can I have a volunteer, please? Yep, you'll do nicely. Come. That'll be easy because you're at the front. You don't have to do anything. All right, so here's how it works. We would have a gathering like this, if you'd like to come to the front. And we'd do this about once a week, and you would, to your peers, confess all of your political crimes and mistakes of the last week. So just name one. What have you done wrong?
I've done wrong. I submitted an essay a little bit late.
Right, then all of you would yell and scream and hurl abuse.
Try harder next time.
You guys are no good as totalitarian minions. Come on. So yeah, that would happen, and then I would be the overseer, and I would say, oh, you have to go and recite Kim Il-sung's thought 100 times, like saying the Hail Mary 100 times. But
okay.
And then if your crimes were really bad, we might say, oh, you will have to go do some hard labour in the prison camps for a while. And then you'd go sit down. Thank you very much. Round of applause. And then we'd repeat that for everyone here. So when everyone's attacking everyone else, what's the end consequence for how you relate to other people?
Negatively.
Yeah. So what's the political outcome of that? Yep, that's right. And what?
Trust.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You can't trust anyone else. No one else can help you but one person. Who's the one person? The leader. So this is why ritual is really important in the personality cult. And what about on the South Korean side? South Korean nationalism. Anti-communism is a big thing. If we think about the importance of anti-imperialism, being anti-Japanese, being anti-American on the other side of the peninsula, well, being anti-communist is a religion in itself in the South. South Korea has even instituted it as a law. I think it's called the National Security Law, where anyone who says anything remotely leftist or is considered a crime against the South Korean state and can be dealt with harshly. Well, that's relaxed somewhat in the last 20 years, but during the Cold War, this was deadly serious. Remember, authoritarian state, and the national security law is one of these authoritarian remnants that remains today. So what do you think the outcome is for the range of political debate that happens in South Korean society of having 50 years of this kind of politics? So just as in the United States we had the McCarthyist era, in South Korea we've had something similar for quite a long time. Yeah. So over time, what if you've got this as your ideological spectrum, it shrinks to your right. So it's quite a right-wing bias or orientation in South Korean politics that's quite noticeable. What we also see in South Korea is economic triumphalism. We see worship of economic growth and development. These ends are subsumed or subsume all else. They become of central importance to the government and to the society. And the society is arranged around achieving these goals. So in South Korea we see big companies set up called Chaebol. Has anyone heard that term before? Yeah, so these are big industrial conglomerates centred around a family oligarchy usually. Think of any names of South Korean companies?
Daewoo.
Yep, that's one. What else?
Samsung.
Hyundai. Yep.
LG. Honda.
That's a Japanese one, but there's a similar thing.
Kia.
SsangYong. They have those four-wheel drives that not many people drive. Yeah, all of these companies are massive industrial units. And they encompass all kinds of economic activities. So Kia doesn't just make cars. Kia makes all kinds of stuff, just like Hyundai, just like Samsung. They cover vast slabs of the economy. And these were set up to fast-track economic development in South Korea. So in a way, it's kind of a style of central planning, capitalist style. Which leads us to the economic contest that's been going on here. If you have different ideology, it's a sure bet that you're going to have different ideas about how you should develop your society economically. How are we going for time? Yeah, I just noticed that. Hasn't moved.
2:43.
All right, a couple more slides and then we'll have a break. Okay, this is a picture of what's now metropolitan Seoul. This was taken just after the Korean War. What do you notice about it?
Not very nice.
No, doesn't look. Riverside real estate's never looked so bad. Yes, I have. Looks like a road, doesn't it? From the air. What do you notice about this? Yep. Yep. Yeah, single story, underdeveloped, dirty, no infrastructure. It's third world, isn't it? So it's important to remember when we look at South Korea today, it's a modern industrial power. Not so long ago, in living memory, this was it. This was the height of South Korean society. You go outside Seoul and it's even worse. That's Seoul today. It's a city, the greater metropolitan area of Seoul, houses 23 million people. And from this spot you can have a 360 degree view around you that looks all like that. An amazing city, very cosmopolitan city. So what we've seen in South Korea is a compressed industrial revolution. Something that's taken the West 200 years has happened in this society in 50 years. You know, an enormously rapid rate of change. And that has implications for culture and society too. You have social norms that haven't caught up to the reality of what society's like. So when I first went to South Korea, materially, all very familiar to me. Culturally, it was another universe that I didn't understand and had very much trouble adapting to. as most people do on their first foray overseas. Who's this man? Anyone know his name?
Im Yung Bak.
Yeah, that's right. Im Yung Bak. Spelt Lee, but in Korean it's pronounced E. And that's right, he's the South Korean president at the moment. And he's presiding over a country that is a global economic power now. It's a member of the G20. That's an important player in the international economy. Important trade partner for Australia as well. Do you know where South Korea ranks as a trade partner for Australia? It's about that. It's in the top four, along with Japan, China, and the United States. So, really important country for us. Like China, they gobble up a lot of our natural resources. Now, what about on the other side of the DMZ? Initially, when the communist system there was set up, the economy was organised around central planning. So they would say that rather than the market being used to sort out resource and manpower allocations, the state bureaucracy could do this. The state bureaucracy could figure out, you know, many millions of different allocation decisions that would take place in any one year. Does anyone know how central planning works? Have you studied this in other subjects? No. Is anyone doing INR with Joe Camilleri? Yeah, he sort of delves into this a little bit, but not really. So what happens? Central planning, you've got your state bureaucracy. And they have, you know, the very biggest decisions to make. So they allocate resources to the next level of the bureaucracy down below them. So each unit gets its allocation. Then the units below them get their allocation from that lot. And then it goes down to the local level. And the local guys on the ground get their allocation of resources and manpower. Does this work? Sounds a lot like how big companies operate and the public service operates here, doesn't it?
Theoretically, yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, it is. Why is it inefficient?
Too many layers of bureaucracy, too many middlemen.
Yeah.
Graphs, corruption cuts.
Yeah, that's a good point. So we're not talking about robots making these decisions. These are people who are trying to climb the tree of the bureaucracy, trying to enrich themselves on the side, trying to make themselves look good. So they're going to falsify information in order to increase their allocation and decrease the amount of work that they're meant to perform under the plan. So it's good to have lots of resources, and it's good to have to not to work too hard, especially if those orders that you're meant to fulfil are, you know, unreasonable but can't be done. So what's a consequence of this? I won't expect you to know that one. You get bottlenecks throughout the economy. So some companies end up having too much of a natural resource and they can't get any of another thing that's important to their operations. Or they can't get any manpower to carry out their operations. So what happens to industrial production? Yeah, that's right. It either slows down or it stops. It stops, starts, and this is incredibly inefficient. And so when your economy behaves like this over a long period of time, you can see how it decays and ends up collapsing in on itself. Another aspect of the North Korean economy is, or was, agricultural collectivisation. So if I'm the North Korean government and I'm making an agricultural collective, what am I doing? What existed there before? And after I collectivise, what's there then?
There used to be farms run by people who owned the farms. They stopped and sold it in the markets. Mm. And now you've made it into one thing. I mean, where everyone farms the same block of land and they have a set amount of crop they have to deliver, they can only make that crop that's dictated by the state.
Yep, that's exactly right. So imagine that all of you are farmers. and you might have like a 10-acre farm each, and you're doing that for subsistence, and whatever's left over you sell at the marketplace for a bit of a profit. Now the North Korean government comes in and says, okay, we think this is inefficient and we object to your profit making on ideological grounds. So you no longer own your land. We, the state, own the land, and you are going to be workers on the land. So it's one big farm instead of lots of little farms, one big farm. And in effect, you're not farmers anymore. You're proletarian industrial workers, just like your brothers in the factories. And that's the intent, to make you ideologically compatible with the system by turning you into members of the proletariat rather than bourgeois farmers who, out of necessity, sell their surplus to make some money. Does that make sense? Now, if you're working in here, what's your motive to produce more? No, it's other than do it for the leader, or do it not to get beaten or sent to the camps or something worse. Is that very efficient? No. And again, we see production over time starts to stagnate. You see people start to steal from the farms, so what is produced doesn't all end up in the state's coffers. So it's a system that was in decay. Now, after a while, the system enters such an advanced state of decay that it's beyond redemption. And it can take some kind of trigger event to destroy those systems. So 1991, very important global event. What happens? Yeah, the collapse of the Soviet Union. So I said before, North Korea, although it preaches self-reliance, is actually incredibly dependent on all kinds of inputs to run its economy, including energy, including fertilizers, including food to produce its people, because there's more people there than the land can support, including agricultural machinery and spare parts and all kinds of things. Gets this stuff from the communist bloc after 1991, all of these things are no longer available. And the system falls apart. State almost fails. We have a great famine where approximately 600,000 people die, possibly more than that. So what we see now as a result of that is a growth of grassroots entrepreneurialism, where people, because the state doesn't function anymore, people have to look after themselves. They have to develop coping strategies to eat and get by and make a living in the absence of the state, which previously provided all of those opportunities. And we see things like that, a small old lady selling little bits of snack food on the side of the road. That's what capitalism looks like in its very embryonic stages, not what we're used to today. All right. Let's pause there for a minute. Let's take five and come back on the hour. All right, let's start again. Hopefully we'll have a little bit of time at the end for some questions if you've got any. So jot them down if you've got anything you'd like to ask me at the end. That's the context, the first hour. Now let's look at some current issues on the Korean Peninsula. And the one that is the obvious one is nuclear weapons proliferation. So let's get a multiplicity of views on this. Clearly, nuclear weapons is a strategic thing. It's a national security dimension to this. Imagine that you're a North Korean military strategist. What's your rationale for developing nuclear weapons? Self-defense. Yep.
Deterrence.
Deterrence. Who are we deterring?
North Koreans.
Yeah, the North Koreans are developing nukes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So, obvious answer. They're deterring the United States. And why would they want to deter the United States?
Give them away.
Yeah. Yeah. So especially if you've got a guy like George W. Bush talking openly about regime change, sitting on an arsenal of 10,000 plus nuclear weapons, from a North Korean perspective, you can mount a pretty persuasive case that we need some of these. What's another possible reason North Korea might want them?
Political economy.
Yeah. So you haven't read my article, have you?
No, maybe.
It's coming. So yes, political economy. What benefits might nuclear weapons bring to government over and above strategic deterrence?
Bargaining.
Yep. So how would they use it?
Concession of, an attaining concession.
Yeah.
Sanctions or something.
Yeah. So if you've got this program, or if people think you've got this program, or you're hinting that you've got this nuclear program, what you do if you want to extract concessions from the international community is engineer small crises events. And then the international community goes, oh my goodness, this is a gross escalation, it's a threat to security. And then North Korea says, okay, we'll de-escalate if you give us 10,000 tons of heavy fuel oil, or if you give us a certain amount of food and fertilizer, or $5 billion in cash. That's exactly what it is, but it works. Why else? What other political economy things might there be?
Maybe China.
What? Yeah, that's right. So it's a good bargaining chip to use with your friends as well as with your enemies. That's a very good point.
Legitimacy too. So you're part of the nuclear circle as opposed to just being one of another 100 to 200 countries.
Yeah, so if North Korea wasn't a nuclear weapons power, how much attention would they be paid in international politics? Not much. They're a small country, economically backward. No, they're irrelevant, except that they have developed nuclear weapons. That puts them on the map. That gives them international prestige that they wouldn't otherwise have. Now, once these programs have been developed, of course, then you have something called the sunk cost effect, or bureaucratic momentum, where it's once you have a complex program like this, it's extremely hard to shut it down. Because people lose their jobs, people's careers are invested in its maintenance. Very difficult. And a lot of money's been spent on them. Now what about South Korea? If you're a South Korean strategic planner and you're seeing this development, what are your thoughts? What do you reckon? Over here somewhere, what do you guys think?
Concerned.
Yeah. Why would you be concerned?
Well, your political ally is the US.
Yeah.
To alleviate their problems, but you can't really do that if it's challenging your security
supplies. Yeah, that's a very good point. So South Koreans are thinking, they're our brothers, they're not going to attack us. But they might just drag the Americans into a war with them, and then that's where it punishes us. The flip side of the coin is South Koreans might be thinking, okay, when the North Korean regime collapses, we will inherit these nuclear weapons and become a nuclear power ourselves when the country's unified. So the South Koreans aren't quite as anti this program as you might believe. What about the Chinese? They see this development. What are they thinking? If you're a Chinese strategic planner, why don't they like it?
Because there's a nuclear power on their doorstep.
Yep. So I went to a city called Yanji, which is right up near the North Korean border in China, in December. And in 2009, when the North had their last nuclear test, that city suffered an earthquake of 4.5 on the Richter. because it's only 80 kilometres away from the test site. Now, it's not the earthquake that's a concern, it's the danger of release of radioactive materials that could quite easily pollute them there. So that's a direct concern. An indirect or strategic concerns for China is that, again, it antagonises the United States unnecessarily at a tense time during this hegemonic contest between China and the US. What about the Japanese? What might they think of this development? Yeah, yeah. Which country is the only one that's been attacked by nuclear weapons?
No.
Yeah, so there's a very serious historical memory going on here that has a powerful effect on how Japanese people view this. What about if you're in Washington and you're an American strategic planner? How do you see this?
They're not going to get dragged into a war. If North Korea attacks one of their allies, they're not obliged, but they're under a lot of pressure to respond.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So this pissy little country is creating problems that they don't need. Yeah.
It escalates it from a regional conflict to a global conflict, doesn't it? Is that if you've got intercontinental ballistic missiles that could hit Russia, India, Japan, all kinds of areas, it's not purely located to the Korean Peninsula anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And it sets a bad example for other countries that might want to proliferate nuclear weapons. It really exposes American weakness. There's nothing the US can do about this. They can't attack because the North Koreans will attack Seoul. The city of Seoul is only 40 kilometres away from the demilitarised zone. The North Koreans have hundreds of short-range rockets and artillery pieces heavily dug in, and that city, the South Korean capital, is indefensible. It has 3 minutes warning before it gets flattened. So, you know, if you're someone in Washington, you can't seriously consider war against North Korea knowing that that's the outcome. Your ally's going to have the centre of its nation destroyed. So, yes, North Korea exposes the United States' weakness. At a time when it's considered that the United States is in decline, this proves it, really. And also undermines the global non-proliferation regime and exposes the hypocrisies that lie within it. Which brings us to international diplomacy. So even though North Korea, there's no real credible way that the international community can make them relinquish their nuclear weapons, should the six-party talks still stay in place? Is there anything to negotiate? So to backtrack, what's the six-party talks? Who's in it?
Russia, DPRK, ROK, Japan, China, and US.
Yep. That's right. So all the Northeast Asian players, they're all in there. So the original rationale is let's prevent North Korea through diplomacy from developing this nuclear program. The Americans hoped that if they brought the pressure of all the regional states to bear on North Korea, that that would force North Korea to make concessions that it otherwise might not if it was just the United States bargaining with them. But it hasn't quite worked out that way. Some of those countries don't necessarily want to put pressure on North Korea. Why might that be the case?
Can I see the role it plays in destabilizing the US?
Yep. What happens if North Korea collapses? What are the ramifications of that event? Yeah.
North Korea's going to go into China.
Yeah. Yeah, and by a lot we mean many millions of North Korean refugees. So imagine if 2 or 3 million people came from New South Wales into Victoria. What kind of socio-economic issues does that entail for Victoria as the receiving region of this rapid refugee influx?
Unemployment is likely to go up and put pressure on existing jobs.
Yep. That would be horrific.
Get paid for the food, their accommodation.
Yeah, that's right. There's all these issues associated with housing people at short notice when you're not really ready to receive them. And that has a big economic cost and can have big effects as far as social cohesion goes. None of these countries in the region want that. China certainly doesn't want it. The South Koreans don't want it. So they're not really serious about putting pressure on North Korea. They want to maintain this regime so that they don't have to face that nightmare reality of a collapse scenario. What they're really looking for is a sort of gradual evolution of the North Korean state, a la the Chinese model, a gradual economic and political reforms. But whether that's possible is another story. Now, also, we talked about using nuclear weapons as a bargaining chip. This is where it happens in the six-party talks. And North Korea is very adept at exploiting the different strategic priorities of the states within the six-party talks to get what it wants. So remember, it used that playing them off divide-and-conquer tactics against China and the Soviet Union during the Cold War. It's exactly the same principle of statecraft at play here. Now, food and energy security are real big-ticket issues that are starting to hit the radar in international relations around the world at the moment. And they're very visible in Northeast Asia and the Korean Peninsula in particular. So I gather lots of you might have seen this particular photo. It's a nighttime satellite photo of Northeast Asia. What information can you glean from this particular graphic? No. No, it's very dark, isn't it? Yep, yep. So, yeah, yep.
Seoul's a really big city.
Yeah, it is. That's a great example of Seoul here. There's Pyongyang. I lived for a time in this place here, a place called Dandong, which is on the Yalu River, facing North Korea. And it was amazing. On the Chinese side, Dandong was lit up like Las Vegas, and on the other side, the town of Xinweiju was dark at night time. It was amazing. And that's a big town. It's not a small place. But it really illustrates the difference in development going on here. Now, one of the reasons we have this issue for North Korea is the fact that Korean Peninsula, on both sides, have no indigenous fossil fuel energy resources of their own. They're completely dependent on external suppliers. So why is it that the South lit up like a Christmas tree and the North's not? What are the differences here? Yeah, so South Korea buys energy on international energy markets. And what do you have to do to buy things on the international marketplace? What do you need? Yeah, you need to generate some kind of income from other activities in order to purchase these things. What does North Korea export to the outside world?
Beer.
Very bad beer, and not enough to buy oil on the international markets. They've chosen this self-reliance path because their former markets in the communist bloc have collapsed. They don't have an export sector of any note, apart from if we look at weapons and missile systems, they sell to a few dictatorships and a couple of other things. But by and large, they don't generate enough income from export activities to purchase energy on the international marketplace, which means they go dark. And what they get from China through aid and concessions and through coercive bargaining from other countries. Now, what does this mean for South Korea? South Korea's got the same problem. It gets energy from the Middle East, like so many other countries. It's completely dependent. So what are the strategic consequences of this kind of energy dependency for South Korea?
Alliances.
Yeah. So this is another reason to be in the US alliance. It also means to get a shipment of oil from the Middle East to South Korea. How does it get there?
Through the Malacca Strait.
Yeah, that's right. Through important sea lines of communication, or SLOCs. And those sea lines are available, or it's possible that they can be disrupted for whatever reason, whether it's a big storm, whether it's a war, or hostile acts on the part of an enemy nation. The oil has to get there from the other side of the world, which is a problem. They're also vulnerable to fluctuations in the price of oil and of global energy supplies. What about food security? Now, I love looking at topographic maps of countries. You can tell a lot about a country's foreign policy orientation and foreign policy goals just by looking at a topographic map, because it tells you what a country's got going for it geographically and what it needs to get from elsewhere. So if you're looking at the Korean Peninsula, what are the key geographic features here that you see?
It's a peninsula.
Yep. Yeah, that's an obvious one. What's the topography like? Sorry? Yeah, it is. It is good for good seafood there. Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. It's very mountainous. There's not a lot of good flat farmland that can be used, which means there's a limit on how much food you can grow for yourself. Now, back before the division of the peninsula, the south used to be the food bowl of the whole peninsula. Now with the division, the north doesn't have access to that food, the primary food bowl region that used to service it when the country was united. So it means automatically, before you even begin, you put that line there and North Korea has a food security problem. So again, what are your options for obtaining food if you can't grow enough for yourself? It's the same deal as with energy. You have to get it from outside by one means or another. And South Korea's options for doing that are much better than North Korea's options, for exactly the same reasons as apply to energy. The final thing I'm going to look at today is the internal politics of both countries as they stand right at the minute. And there's some interesting things going on in both South Korea and North Korea. So let's hit the South at the moment. I talked before about how the spectrum of political debate had really narrowed to the right in South Korea over the course of the Cold War. Well, since that time, in the last 20 years, we've seen a little bit of a split in South Korean politics between liberals and conservatives. I mean, everyone's on the right, but some are more on the right than others, a bit like the United States. So after the fall of the Soviet Union, North Korea is a very weak state. It's clear that South Korea's won the contest in terms of economy, ideology, etc. Some people in South Korea think, well, okay, North Korea's not as much of a threat as it used to be. We're not scared of them anymore. We don't have to have some of these repressive laws. We can show a bit more benevolence to North Korea and help them out through their difficult situation. And hopefully that might lead to reintegration at some stage in the future. Whereas the conservatives still hold the old Cold War line that you must take a tough stance against North Korea no matter what the cost, and they're very hard line. The conservatives are also very much in favour of the American alliance and keeping that strong, whereas the liberals tend to de-emphasise the American alliance and say, okay, we can begin to move away from the United States to a degree and start to pursue a more independent foreign policy. It's not to say that they advocate completely ditching the alliance, but they want more scope for independent action within it. Now, at the moment, we've already met this guy, Lee Myung-bak. He's a conservative. It's a period of conservative ascendancy in North Korea at the moment. This comes after This guy, Kim Dae-jung, brought in something called the Sunshine Policy. He was a liberal, and he believed that relations with North Korea could be improved through the establishment of economic and cultural linkages between the two countries. And this culminated in this summit between South Korea and North Korea in the year 2000. But over the course of the last 10 years, from 2000 onwards, North Korea kept engaging in provocative behaviour, and there wasn't a sense that there was reciprocal action. South Korea was giving a lot and not getting anything back. And this really discredited the liberals and discredited Kim Dae-jung and his successor, Noh Myo-hun, and led to the election of Im Jong-bak and the conservative faction, who promised to take a more stronger line with North Korea and ask for reciprocal action. We give you something, you have to give us something back. Incidentally, that tactic hasn't worked out too well and has led to the stalemate in the six-party talks that exists at the moment. And as you know, North Korean former leader now Kim Jong-il died at the end of last year and has brought on a leadership transition phase, only the second one in the history of North Korea. So who's the new leader? Kim Jong-un. How old is he? He's about 29 now. He's younger than me. And I can't, for the life of me, think of how I would run a country being this young with no life experience. But North Korea now is being run by this very young man who has about 3 or 4 years experience in the state bureaucracy. Now, one of the fears is that he doesn't really run the show. Kim Jong-il was groomed for 20 years to take on the leadership before he actually assumed power in 1994. Kim Jong-un has had 2 or 3 years to do the same task. So in that grooming phase, when we talk about grooming a leader, what kind of things are involved in that? Especially in a country that's a one-person dictatorship.
Building networks.
Yeah, so what kind of networks? Who would it be good to be friends with in the bureaucracy? Yes, the military. Yeah, so all of the key people in the regime structure who occupy critical nodes of power, these are people that Kim Jong-un needs to have on side. And at the moment, it's not clear that he's been able to establish these strong relationships in the same way that his father did. He may well have, and he may well have strong support within the regime, but it's too early to tell, and we'll know a bit more about that as this year progresses and as we move along. And there he is, our new young leader. Obviously not wanting for food, as the rest of his subjects are. All right, that concludes my formal remarks. Is there any questions? Yeah.
How did you visit North Korea?
There's a few, about 5 or 6 different tourist organisations that run chaperoned tours into North Korea, but they're very expensive. And you're with a minder all the time. So let's say there's a tour of 10 people. There'll probably be 5 North Korean government officials that travel with you everywhere you go. They take you to prearranged places, show you what they want you to see, and tell you if you're not meant to be somewhere or taking a photo of something that you shouldn't be taking a photo of. So yeah, it's all very staged. The Potemkin Village effect that we were talking about earlier.
I think there were a few documentaries
there's a diplomatic faux pas when 2 American journalists were detained for a long period of time before being released when Bill Clinton went over.
Yeah, so they were up in Yanji near where I was. Let's see if I can get a map here. They were up here. And there's not much security up here. It's just a river. It's like crossing the Murray. There's not much security. And these 2 American journalists were ethnic Korean Americans. So they tried to pass themselves off as natives. But of course, you know, that's impossible. Even South Koreans going into North Korea, there's so many cultural differences and differences in body language and expression and all kinds of things, that they stick out like a sore thumb, and they were apprehended pretty quickly. It's unclear whether they were actually on the North Korean side or not. That's a matter for dispute. But nonetheless, they were captured and were held in Pyongyang for quite a while until Bill Clinton went over there on a diplomatic mission and got them back. But nothing in international relations is free. The Americans had to provide a whole suite of incentives to North Korea to get these journalists back. So if I was Hillary Clinton, I'd be very upset that these journalists got themselves in trouble and cost the American government some face. That's a good question. The common theory is that once North Korea falls apart, then South Korea will step in and it'll be one big Korea. But there's a lot of consequences to that eventuality that means it might not be as likely as we think. It might not be such a smooth transition. So for one, if the Chinese government, if they're worried about the refugee problem, if there's any hint of collapse, they might send troops straight into the north to stabilise, and they might not leave. The Americans might do the same thing from the other end, and then what happens if they meet up? So they could. This is a volatile scenario, because you've got to stabilise the situation. If there's a rapid collapse, you've got to stabilise what's going on in that country very quickly, otherwise it can scale into a very big humanitarian disaster very fast. So ideally, all the members of the six-party talks would have contingency plans about, in this eventuality, they'll all work together to ensure stability within the north. But it's not an easy thing to do, as we've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan. But as for more evolutionary scenarios, that was the idea of the sunshine policy of South Korea. We'll try and, on the sly, inject capitalism and inject political reforms into North Korea through economic cooperation and cultural cooperation. But the North Koreans know what's going on. They don't want to change, or the government doesn't want to change this system. They like this system. There's no future for these people if the system collapses. So they're against any kind of liberalisation. Yep, Tom?
What's the possibilities of a domestic uprising?
Pretty small.
Well, in the event that it starved itself to the point of no return, so to speak.
Yeah, these good questions. So, what do you need for a successful revolution?
Things get better. That's generally the kicking point.
Yeah, so when things start to improve, why would that be
people
handy?
Want more. Once you get a taste of change, you want more.
Yeah, and if people are in real distress, what aren't they worried about? Politics. They're worried about survival. Where am I going to eat? How am I going to survive? Where am I going to sleep tonight? All of these things are much more important than
the government's going to be providing that. You already talked about it. Grassroots entrepreneurship. Hypothetically, if there was another famine, could that eventually lead to the government collapse? Because essentially, people just aren't listening to them anymore. And presumably, stuff.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's more likely that the government might collapse because of the economic ramifications of that rather than people rising up. It might just be that the system's so unsustainable that it collapses on its own weight. But as for people sort of rising up, well, you've got a system, a political system that atomises people, keeps them separated at every level from all their other people. Because we talked about the self-criticism sessions before, the whole idea is that it isolates you. You can't trust anyone but the leader, but the state. So what does that do to civil society? Yeah, that's right. And so it's really hard for people to organise collectively, to plan a revolution. So
how possible would it be that the military will
turn against? That's much more likely, sort of a military coup. And the military takes control. I'd put that down as one possibility of the leadership transition, to end up with something like a collective military leadership like Burma, where there's a bunch of the most powerful generals who manage the country rather than one set leader. And that could be what's happening now, that Kim Jong-un is just a figurehead, but the real power is under the throne with these kind of people. But again, we can't know. That may have already happened. It may be speculation. We'll know soon enough.
Given the reasons for the Chinese economic expansion in North Korea, hypothetically, in a North Korean collapse and the Chinese coming to stabilise, would they seek a reunification to kind of get optimal economic, preferential economic treatment?
But reunification with the South or with...
Presuming the South would push for the reunification, is it possible that China would say yes, but we can spend like, very specific sort of economic concessions, like we have access to all these minerals that you get...
So you'd want to preserve whatever relationships are in place, and you'd also specify no US troops above the 38th parallel, because then that erodes your buffer zone. The whole purpose of maintaining North Korea in the first place was to keep American troops off the border, off the frontier. So that would be an interesting scenario.
Is it a difficult country to study? Because it is such a closed society, compared to other countries, there's much less information in and out. Does it make it difficult?
Yeah, it does. But also makes it kind of exciting too, because you're piecing together a jigsaw from all kinds of different types of information that on their own don't tell you everything, but when you piece them together, you're looking for stuff that corroborates other sources of information, and hopefully you're constructing a picture of the whole. But it's not completely closed. If it was completely closed, we wouldn't know anything. So obviously we do know something, so it's not opaque, but it is difficult to study for those reasons. So like other countries, the best way to find out about them is to go there or to visit places around them and see it for yourself, and speak to people that have been there. There's lots of organisations that have been doing aid work. I know, for example, in Wagga Wagga, there's some people from Charles Sturt University that worked on an AIDS project in North Korea, and I'm going to speak with them next week. So that's the kind of people that you go and see, with people with direct experience. Yeah, any other questions? Yeah. I'll come back to you in a sec. Yeah. There were lots of people whose families were split in half by this division. And interestingly, in Seoul at the National War Museum, there's a famous statue of two brothers. One was fighting on one side and the other, and they met on the battlefield and hugged. And this is a really famous image. But it represents the fact that lots of families were torn in half and never saw each other again. Until around that time of the 2000 summit with the Sunshine Program, there were some meetings arranged where families that had been torn apart, people that were only, you know, in as little kids when the division happened, now they're old people, and they're getting to see their brothers and their sisters again for the first time in 50 years. And you can imagine the kind of emotions that would be swirling around that. But yeah, really tragic. Yeah.
I've read a lot of reports from people who escaped from North Korea to South Korea, and they're just devastated because they can't even reach out to their family in North Korea out of the fear that if they find out that they have bonds with someone who escaped, that they might be executed or even treated worse. And as far as relationships between North and South, I'm sure you've seen the movie Tagged Pete. So yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a good point. Collective punishment is practiced in North Korea. So let's say I commit a crime of some kind, and especially leaving the country, if I leave any family or friends behind, then they're likely to get sent to re-education camps as a punishment, as a deterrent to other people from doing that exact thing. So if you're leaving, you've got to be really honest and brutal about what's going to happen to the people you leave behind, or you bring them with you. And it's as simple as that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you go. Sorry, I might forget. We can't get in them. They're not acknowledged to exist. They're up in this area here. It's not that densely populated up here. Very mountainous, very cold, really harsh, oppressive conditions. And they're only known because some people have been in them and have managed to defect. So there's one, a famous book called The Aquariums of Pyongyang, written about 10 years ago by a guy who was in there in a camp for 10 years, was released, then defected to the United States. So that gives you a real flavour of what it's like in there. Yeah, sorry.
I was going to think you would say the same thing. There's a story recently in the last month or so about a person who from out of a camp in the north and he's in America now, but written a bit like a big long. It was like, you know, his father had committed a crime and so his mother and his brother and himself.
Yeah.
And then he met people and was, and then they planned to escape together and one of his bacon and all this stuff. But, like, international, I mean, now if he's in America, or people go to other countries, so they try and use that, those resources, obviously, to affect their policies on how they deal with North Korea and what's going on.
Not so much other countries, but what defectors will do is try and embellish their story so that they can get asylum. And so it's not always the best form of information to use about what's going on in there, because it may or may not be accurate, but it's very hard to verify, so you have to take that info with a grain of salt.
In terms of these boot camps, there's the North Korean government use them as like a form of labour in terms of the way that like China or even the US does.
So that you might have a coal mine.
They actually export.
Perhaps not for export, but definitely for domestic consumption. So you might have a coal mine where people are working 16-hour days. They don't care if the people die in the mine. That's not the point. The production of coal is a byproduct to the punishment. But it's a useful byproduct. Yeah.
In regards to the sort of that military first, I think it's the Songun. Policy. Does that create a lot of antagonism between the military and the general population?
North Korea is a garrison state, which means the military and the society are heavily interwoven together. Everyone has to do compulsory military service for 10 years. Up until they're 28. You have to do it in the South, but only for 2 years after you finish high school. So everyone has been through the system. They're creatures of the system. They have relatives in the system. So it's hard to say, are there antagonisms? Well, perhaps because the military gets first cut on any resources that come through the economy, well, then you could make the case that there could be envy and jealousy developing there. But then again, it's not the whole military. It's higher echelons of the military that are seeing that benefit rather than the average grunts at the bottom. So, again, hard to say. They're the kind of questions that are really hard to put a finger on. Yeah. When you're dealing with a state that has an information blockade.
The group you were saying before that you're visiting today, doing aid work, or trying to organise, are they like doing it from here, or?
Yeah, they were part of the New South Wales government and the working with the Food and Agriculture Organisation. So there's international organisations that get funding grants from governments to go and help with food security problems.
So they're able to go into...
Yeah, but again, their activities are very heavily monitored. Who they talk to is heavily restricted. But again, what you don't get to see is also instructive.
Yeah.
All right, how are we going for time? Tell the truth too.
Quarter two.
All right, any other questions? I think we can wrap up early. All right, thank you very much for coming, and you've been a great audience. Cheers.